Good morning. 7 past the hour at Faith Radio. The country of China has seen huge changes in the past 30 years. How have those changes been impacting Christians in that country? Here to provide a firsthand account of what's been happening in China is Joanne Pittman. She's Senior Vice President of China Source. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. So nice to have you join us. First of all, tell us a little bit about the history and the mission of the China Source ministry.
China Source is a ministry that's been around since the 1990s, and it was formed in the 1990s to provide a platform of collaboration between various ministries that were working in China at the time, but not necessarily talking or working together. And so we were formed to provide a platform for ministries to come together and share best practices and look for ways for to collaborate and partner together. And now we focus primarily on providing content and resources for ministries in China and people serving in China. So we like to say that we're serving those who serve in China.
That's wonderful. Now, you lived and worked in China for more than 3 decades, and you just wrote an article, retrospective article, on some of the changes that you've seen in that country during that time. And I'd love to have you describe a few of those changes for us. I think it'll give our Faith Radio listeners a better feel for what's happening in that country, particularly as it pertains to the church. And one of the changes you describe and use this title, ration coupons to Walmart. How have the changes in China's economy in recent years impacted the average Chinese citizen?
Well, yes, I wrote this piece a while back, and we just put it on our website. I went to China in 1984 as an English teacher and for what I thought was going to be 1 year, and then I ended up staying until I moved back to Minnesota in 2012. And the China that I went to in 1984 is very, very different from the China that I left in 2012. In 1984, China was still less than 10 years out of the Cultural Revolution, which was a 10-year period of chaos and almost virtually no economic activity in the country. And I remember when I went in 1984, the people still had ration coupons that limited the amount of meat and eggs and flour and sort of basic staples that they could buy because there was scarcity. And I was able to watch that change. And then in the mid-1990s, when the economic reforms really began to take off and China set about on a course of really turning itself into the economic powerhouse that we see today. And so, you know, I think back, you know, when I went in the 80s, you know, there was a grocery store and there was, you know, in the winter, the only thing that was available was cabbage to eat. And now, you know, Chinese cities are full of big box stores and Walmart. And there really is, especially in the cities, there's just no scarcity. And China is now the second largest economy in the world.
Now, help me understand this, because I think for a lot of us, it's kind of confusing. You have this communist nation, but they really have sort of a modified capitalist system there. How do those two fit together?
Well, that's part of the fun of being a China watcher and somebody who lives in China, is that everything about China is confusing. In fact, in one of my favorite books about China by NPR correspondent Rob Gifford, he makes the statement that if you're not confused, you're not paying attention. So anybody who pays attention to China is confused. But China, it is unique in the sense that it is still ruled by the Chinese Communist Party, which maintains still very strict control. But the Communist Party is overseeing and managing a fairly freewheeling free market economy. Not entirely. There are still sectors of the economy like natural resources and the media and education and all of that, which are still directly controlled by the government. But there is this free market capitalism that is sort of exploding and very vibrant. But it's all being managed by a Chinese Communist Party, which doesn't make sense. But it's kind of working.
It sounds like it's working. I mean, we had ups and downs in the Chinese economy, certainly, and that impacts our economy and our stock market because with, you know, global economic connections now, we see those things. Our stock market, you know, gets hammered when China's, you know, GDP drops or whatever. Now,
yes.
another change that you describe in your article is isolated to engaged. How engaged is China now with other countries? Does that engagement go beyond simply economic partnerships?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, obviously, China is a major player on the world economic stage. But Chinese people today are much more connected at more of an individual level with the outside world. I think I wrote in my piece that when I first went to China in the 80s, most of my students had never even met a foreigner, somebody from outside of China. It was, you know, it was a novelty, and I would ask them, you know, questions like, you know, if you could travel anywhere in the world, where would you like to go? And they really couldn't even process that question because it was like asking me, would you prefer to go to Mars or Venus? it was totally out of the realm of possibility. And now Chinese people are traveling all over the world. They're some of the biggest spenders, you know, for international tourism dollars. And the internet has given them access to the outside world. And so, you know, Chinese young people today, they're essentially watching the same movies and television shows. The government tries to, you know, kind of manage and you know, control what gets in. But it's very difficult to do. And so Chinese today are they're interconnected with the world, particularly people in the cities. In the countryside, maybe not quite as much. But so they're more... They're not just participating in the global economic culture, they're participating in the global popular culture as well.
It's fascinating. Our guest is Joanne Pittman. She's with the Ministry China Source. We'll have more with Joanne and find out about what's happening with the church. Are Christians still being persecuted en masse in China, or are things getting better? Stick with us. Welcome back. 16 past the hour, Faith Radio. It's Bill Meyer with Joanne Pittman from the Ministry China Source. Joanne spent 30 years in China, now back in the Faith Radio state of Minnesota. And Joanne, you wrote this great retrospective article kind of looking at the changes that have occurred in China over the past 30 years. And, you know, in the past, it's been a fairly closed country. We haven't known a lot about what's going on. But in recent years, that's changed. Another change that you describe in your article is conformity to self-expression. I'm wondering, what do you mean by that? How are some of the ways that has manifested itself among the Chinese people in recent years?
Well, I think, as I mentioned before, when I first went to China in the 80s, China was very isolated, and everything was controlled by the government. I mean, in the 80s, particularly in the Cultural Revolution, everybody wore the same clothing, and there was just no room for any individuality or any self-expression. You just simply, your goal was to just, you know, not be noticed, shall we say. And as the changes really began in the 1990s and the government began to kind of loosen its grip on everyday life and society, you saw the reemergence of individual expression, and that would, you know, maybe show itself in where suddenly not everybody's wearing drab blue mouse, you know, what we call mouse suits. They're wearing more colors. They're wearing more, people are wearing different things. And then now, you know, you've got the internet and social media, such a big thing in China today that really, particularly among the younger generation, what we call the post-80s, the post-90s generation in China, self-expression is really important. I need to express myself. I need to show my individuality, and you know, so everything from fashion to architecture in China today sort of screams out, you know, look at me, pay attention to me, which is just completely opposite of what it was in the 1970s and 80s. And as I said, social media in China is really pushing this even further, and people are sharing their ideas, they're sharing their thoughts, they're sharing their opinions on social media, as much if not more than we do in this country.
But what if they say something negative about the Communist Party? I mean, what it would seem that, you know, all this encouragement of self-expression wouldn't sit real well with those in power.
Well, and that's a good point. And I wouldn't say it's necessarily that the encouragement to self-expression is coming from the government. It's more bubbling up from the bottom. But there is a limit. So it's kind of like the government has a tolerance for self-expression so long as it doesn't cross a line into criticism of the government or criticism or challenging the Communist Party's right to be in power. So, you know, you can share about anything, as a Chinese friend of mine said once. Well, we can talk about anything, you know, as long as we don't criticize the government. And so what we see, for example, on the Internet, is this free-willing space, but if somebody who's, you know, posting about what they had for dinner or their cat or whatever suddenly starts posting things that are critical of the government, you know, they'll get a phone call and say, you have to take that down or something worse. So the government tolerates a lot, but it has its limits of what it can tolerate. And what it does not tolerate is any challenge to its rule.
Now, a final major change that you describe in your retrospective article centers on the church. You say the church has gone from hidden to visible. Describe the current state of the Christian church in China, Joanne.
Well, I think going back to the beginning of our conversation, I would say it's confusing, like everything else in China. Generally, what I point out in my article is that the church, you know, back in the 80s, it was hidden. It was just emerging from the persecution era. And as the government has loosened its grip on sort of the daily life of Chinese citizens, that has allowed a space for the reemergence of religion and religious activity in Chinese society, not just Christianity, but Buddhism and Islam and other religions as well. And so the church, I would say, right now in China is growing. Nobody knows how many the total, but it's probably between 50 and 70 million people in China. As far as the Protestant church goes, there are sort of two, there really are three different streams. One would be the what we call the registered church, which is the churches in China that are government sanctioned, they're legal, they have big buildings with crosses and, you know, signs on the top that say Christian church, and, you know, they may have 5,000 people that show up for services every Sunday morning. Then we have the urban unregistered church movement, which is in the past has been called the underground church movement or the house church movement. And these are churches, congregations that for a variety of reasons do not want to associate themselves with the government-sanctioned church. And so they just form these independent congregations on their own. In the 70s and 80s, those were pretty heavily persecuted. But in the last 20 years or so, the government has kind of said, just, you know, as long as you don't cause trouble, we'll leave you alone. And so there's just this kind of tacit, you know, don't bother us, we won't bother you too much. And so in the cities, you have these urban churches that are made up of highly educated people in business. And they're actually quite open as well. Many of the churches in the cities have websites, you know, that say, here's where we meet, and, you know, here's our service time. So I'm no longer really comfortable using the term underground church, because I think if you have a website, you probably can't call yourself an underground church.
Guess not.
But in the countryside, then, too, there's the house church movement in the countryside, but the people are mostly, you know, farmers and have a lower education level. And that's where the explosive growth of the church took place in the 60s and 70s during the era of intense persecution. And I think the current attitude of the government towards Christianity is the same as it is towards everything in society. The government wants to manage or control everything. And so this the house church movement, particularly the urban house church movement, it's gotten big, and it like many things in China, it operates in a gray zone of, you know, it's not really illegal, but it's not legal. But as long as you don't give us trouble, we'll kind of leave you alone. And so I would say, you know, in answer to the persecution question, I think I can quite confidently make this statement that Today, persecution is not the normal experience for most Christians in China. That's not to say it doesn't exist anymore, but whereas in the 60s, it would have been the normal experience for most. That's not the case today. Now, the government right now is sort of in a period of tightening, and they're trying to sort of reassert their control and authority over a lot of these gray areas that have arisen in Chinese culture. And so the church is, I think there's a little bit of a tightening happening right now.
Well, we look forward to hearing more from you, Joanne, in the future, because I'd love to talk about, first of all, what's happening in this one province where some of the churches have been torn down and why that particular province has had that unrest. And then, of course, I know there's been some new regulations that have been passed or are going to be passed by the Chinese government. So, Joanne Pittman with China Source, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate your service for the Lord, 30 years in China. And look forward to having you on Faith Radio again in the near future.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Good morning. 36 past the hour. It's Faith Radio. Why were Russian warships off the coast of England over the weekend? And how could the tensions between the U.S. and Syria be heating up in weeks to come? Here to join us with those stories and more, historian and world affairs expert, Dr. David Aikman. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you for having me on.
First of all, let me ask you about what happened in Iraq over the weekend. There has been a major offensive by Iraqi forces. They're trying to retake the city of Mosul. Give us some background on that situation in that part of the country and how Iraqi forces and the U.S. Backing them up are battling ISIS.
Well, as you probably recall, Mosul, a very important city up in the northwest of the country, was taken over by ISIS in 2014. And along with it, several surrounding towns and villages, mostly Christian. And ISIS, or Islamic State, has been in control of Mosul and has run an absolutely brutal state for the last 2 years. And in order to begin to remove Islamic State completely from Iraqi territory, it's been necessary to go to the power points of where IS is powerful. And so Mosul has emerged as a key strategic point which the Iraqi government has to take back. And, of course, most of the effective fighting against Islamic State has been done by the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces. So the Kurdish forces have been used as part of the spearhead of the attempt to take back Mosul. But the Iraqi army is in slightly better shape than it was when it actually ran away from ISIS 2 years ago. So it's hopeful that between them, Peshmerga and the Iraqi army can actually make headway. They have to start off by cleaning up the villages and towns surrounding Mosul that are in ISIS hands.
Now, we've talked about the idea to create a so-called safe haven in the northern part of the country. On Saturday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel echoed the call for this safe zone. Tell us, once if ISIS can be removed, tell us what this safe zone would entail and the minority groups that would be protected there.
Well, the only way a safe zone would work is if it was genuinely safe, if you had military units, perhaps of the Iraqi army, of Peshmerga, and certainly of NATO or United States origin, making sure that no alien forces was getting into the area to cause harm to the minorities and Yazidis and Christians and other. But there's really no agreement among the coalition partners who are anti-ISIS on how this whole system would work. And I don't think it will work unless the United States takes the lead in saying, this is really too much for Iraq. the international community has to intervene to provide a safe space for Iraqis who are minorities. And, of course, the same thing is true in Syria. I mean, the United States has failed to provide leadership which could really offer an alternative to the continuation of the civil war.
I'm assuming that if this safe space, this zone in northern Iraq was set up, that it would require a major new commitment of U.S. air power.
It would indeed, and it would require a major commitment by the ground forces of the U.S. coalition. You know, obviously the Iraqi army itself and Peshmerga and any of the other allied Arab forces that want to contribute to a peaceful Iraq or at least an ISIS-free Iraq, they'd all have to agree to a unified command and to very clear limits as to what they were supposed to be doing there and what the size of the area should be. It's a real difficult and complex problem to resolve. And the same is true in Syria.
Meanwhile, ISIS continues to indiscriminately kill civilians, and we kind of sit by the sidelines, which is really tragic. David, switching gears, the situation in Syria remains tense. Russian warships headed to the Mediterranean. In fact, a Russian aircraft carrier and battlecruiser spotted in the English Channel just off the coast of Dover. Was this some kind of aggressive show of force by the Russians?
Well, I think it's a show that the Russian military thinks it does have, it has nothing to fear from the United States or anybody else who is trying to stop it doing what it wants to do in Syria. The Russians have had a completely free rein to bomb the daylights out of Aleppo, which is it's the largest city in Syria, and it is still mostly controlled by forces hostile to Bashar al-Assad. But the Russians want to prop up Assad, and so they are using every sort of air power that they can to bomb those parts of the city which are held by rebel groups. And the suffering, the number of deaths has been absolutely astronomical. And, of course, the Syrian regime of Assad has continued to use barrel bombs of chemical warfare to tamp down any opposition to it. It's a frightful situation.
I saw those images of the Russian fleet off the coast of England. How did the British Navy respond when, I mean, I'm assuming they were still in international waters at that point, but what did the British Navy do?
Yeah, they were. Well, they were shadowed by British destroyers and a convoy of other ships to kind of monitor them. But I don't think there was any sort of threat that the British might sort of oppose this movement of shipping, because after all, the English Channel is international waters and there is no conflict going on with Russia. But I think what this demonstrates is that the Russian military seems to think it can do exactly what it wants in the Middle East, and nobody is going to lift a finger to oppose it. And it's obvious that Assad, of course, with the advice of his Russian friends, has spoken publicly to other journalists to say he thinks President Obama is weak and is not going to lift a finger to stop what's going on in Syria. So that's a deplorable situation that we have.
Yes, and unfortunately, it seems like Mr. Putin may agree with that. So we'll dive into the Syria issue a bit more with our friend Dr. David Aikman in just a bit. Stick with us here on Faith Radio. Good morning. It's 47 past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. It's Bill Meyer with Dr. David Aikman, historian, world affairs expert, journalist, and a man who keeps us updated on a regular basis on what's happening around the world. And unfortunately, Syria is really the flashpoint right now between the U.S. and the Russians. there have been some not so veiled threats made by the Russian defense minister in the last week or two. David, can you update us on that war of words and where things currently stand?
Well, yes. I mean, what the Russians are trying to make clear is any attempt by American air power to limit the efforts of the Russians to bomb opposition targets in Syria might be countered by the use of surface-to-air missiles against American aircraft by the Russians. And that's a very serious threat because the Russians have deployed quite advanced anti-aircraft missile systems in Syria, which could indeed be effective against the Americans. But the real issue in Syria is that the U.S. administration has had no clear objective whatever in the Syrian civil war, which has basically gone on for 5 years. When the so-called Arab Spring broke out in about 2010 and 2011, and there were protests in Syria, the call of the administration, particularly of Secretary of State Clinton, was that Assad must go. Well, great. How was the United States going to make that departure come into effect? And the U.S. has been really troubled by its indecision whether to support so-called moderate oppositionists, the Free Syrian Army, who are not Islamists and want a democratic state. And the United States is incapable of building a structure that would create a change of government in a sort of relatively peaceful way in Syria. And since Assad doesn't want to have any change and the Russians back him up, the U.S. is at a complete standstill unless it's prepared to go to military conflict with Russia, which could involve it actually in a major war.
What would happen, David, if the Russians shot down a U.S. jet?
Well, that would be very serious, and the onus would be on the U.S. how to respond. If that happened, all bets are off, because you could have the United States sort of shooting down Russian jets with their own aircraft or their own missile systems, and bringing the conflict between these two proxy allies in Syria to a breaking point. It would be very serious. But if the United States was clear on what its objectives were, and if, for example, the United States were willing to propose a safe zone around Aleppo or to give refugees from Aleppo a space to live in peace, and were able to get international support for that, well, that would be a possible resolution. But so far, there's absolutely nothing on the table.
Meanwhile, civilians continue to die, and we see those terrible images of children in Aleppo who have, you know, been impacted by the bombs and their homes destroyed. And it is so tragic. David, another hot spot in the Middle East right now involves the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And now the U.S. appears to be getting dragged into that conflict. Give us a bit of background. Tell us about U.S. involvement there.
Well, 3 years ago, Yemeni government, which was a legitimate government, was forced to make the then president resign, and he was replaced by another president. And then the Houthis, who are a faction of Yemen that are Shiite and supported by Iran, they moved in and took over the capital city of Sana'a. That brought in the Saudis, who said, we cannot afford to have a Shiite Islamic power right next to us in the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula. So they moved in with full force and with American logistical support for their air power to attack Houthi targets in Sana'a and surrounding parts of Yemen. So the United States has been pulled into Yemen, sort of basically holding the apron strings of the Saudis, but also has become a target of missiles fired at U.S. ships by Houthi rebels, obviously using Iranian-supplied radar. And the United States has responded by cruise missile attacks on those radar facilities in Houthi-held territory of Yemen. So we are, in effect, fighting a proxy war in Yemen, although once again, there is no clear objective stated by the U.S. administration on what we hope to see happen. So it's a very difficult and complex problem.
Mm. David, we've just got about 2 minutes left. On a personal note, you just re-released a version of your novel, When the Almond Tree Blossoms. It was originally published back in 1993, but you have an updated storyline, and in many ways, it's mirroring today's headlines.
Well, yes. Thank you for mentioning that, Bill. I wrote the novel in 1993 when, although President Clinton was in the White House, political tensions were polarizing within the United States, and particularly on the progressive side, if you like, the liberal side, some of the voices were becoming more and more extreme, and there were sort of rumblings of a possible civil war then. Fast forward to the current election cycle, and you have more polarized political bickering between conservatives and progressives than we've ever seen before. And, you know, there is talk of a possible civil war. And in my novel, I depict what would be likely to happen if the progressives took over, let's say, the East Coast, the West Coast, and the Midwest, largely populated city areas, and the red states. The term red states didn't exist in the 1990s, but I'm using it effectively today. The red states had a military that absolutely resisted the unconstitutional takeover of the U.S. government by progressives allied with Russia. In the novel, Russia is a sort of an ultra-nationalist, aggressively nationalistic state, as it is today, and it was willing to prop up a progressive American regime in order to prevent the United States from becoming military strong and an effective opposition to Russia's role in the world. So, if you want to see what life would be like in a progressive control totalitarian state in the United States, read my book, When the Almond Tree Blossoms.
It's fascinating, and I know it's received some really nice praise. The original novel back in 1993 and this updated version really mirroring today's political events, When the Almond Tree Blossoms, by Dr. David Aikman. David, thank you so much for your time today. As always, we appreciate your insights.
Bill, thank you so much for having me on. Bye.